And welcome to the 237th episode of the Atlas Society Asks. My name is Jennifer Anju Grossman. I am so excited to welcome Timur Karan. He is an expert on preference falsification, as well as having done some very interesting research these past few years on the decline in religiosity in the Middle East. So, Timur, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first, we'd just love to start with a little bit of your background, having grown up in Turkey. We were just chatting before we went live, the situation in Turkey there, and maybe anything that might have influenced the later direction of your academic work.
I was born in New York to an Anglo-Mexican mother and a Turkish father. They met at Yale, where my father was studied for 6 years. My mother was in the only department that admitted women at the time, the drama department. My father had, as a hobby, been interested in drama. Well, that he went to watch some plays, so my mother, and that was the beginning of a long romance. Well, after my father graduated, they went to Turkey. I was 3 months old at that time. I grew up in Turkey in an academic family, I should say a secular academic family. And most of the people who came to our home and whom I'd met around the dinner table when they came as guests were also secular. They took it for granted in their discussions that I heard as I was growing up that Islam is a source of backwardness, had put Turkey behind, that and that secularism was an unmitigated advantage. And also that with modernization and development, Islam would disappear. Many question marks appeared in my mind then. I didn't know exactly how to articulate them, but I didn't understand exactly why Islam had been a source of economic underdevelopment, why it was a source of repression, why it would disappear, why it existed at all. And these questions were generally not debated. Sort of the arguments that I mentioned were just taken as granted. Educated people just accepted them. Well, I came to the United States for undergraduate work and then graduate school. I didn't work on religion specifically, but these questions were always in the back of my mind. And when I became a professor, when I took my first job, I started working on these questions. So questions that appeared, that popped into my mind early on, did influence my academic direction and the topics that I chose.
So I first discovered your work during my research and recent interview with Todd Rose about his book, Collective Illusions. But when I learned how you've spent recent years documenting a precipitous decline in religiosity in the Middle East, I knew I had to talk to you to see if you could shed light on a phenomenon that we've been tracking at the Atlas Society. I'll try to make this no longer than it needs to be, but for the past 9 years, we've been producing these short animated Draw My Life videos, creatively engaging young people with concepts like envy, victimhood, greed, as well, of course, as objectivism. And while these videos usually draw about 1 million or so views in English, when we began adapting them into foreign language, we were not prepared for the fact that the Arabic versions by far drew the biggest audiences in engagement. A video that drew 1 million views in English would draw 6, 7, 8 million views in Arabic. So I guess part of the reason for my surprise was that I just assumed that young Arabic speakers would be more deeply religious and would find the reason-based, more secular ideas that we are advancing at the Atlas Society to be more of an anathema. So what does your research tell you?
I'm not surprised at all. Outwardly, most Arab societies are quite religious, but privately, many, possibly even most Arabs who are outwardly Muslim, who practice Islam to one degree or another, have many questions about Islam. Some of them have given up on them. Some of them have actually exited it, and they are just doing what they need to do to be recognized as a Muslim in their society. The regimes in the Middle East are aware of this. They've conducted classified surveys of their own that have been leaked. And they find that the percentage of atheists, percentage of people who characterize themselves as non-religious, or who characterize themselves as deist, believing in a higher being, believing in a god, but not in any specific religion, but this percentage is in double digits. It's in fact in double digits, even in religious schools that are designed to train the next generation of religious experts, imams, religious judges, and so on. In Turkey, there was a classified survey done. It was leaked to the press. It found that 14% of youths at religious schools characterized themselves as something other than Muslim. In Egypt, officially, the number of atheists is something a few hundred, and the number hasn't, I forget the exact number, but it hasn't changed in many years. But a former head of Al-Azhar, that's the highest religious body in Egypt, has said that a substantial portion of the youths and even of middle-aged people are not religious and have privately left Islam, that a substantial share of them are atheists. For Iran, we don't have a similar survey that has been leaked. We don't know if any has been done, though I'd be surprised if the theocracy has not conducted such surveys. But just looking at a crowd on a busy street in Tehran or Isfahan or some other Iranian city will provide many indications that Iranians are not particularly religious, that they are openly defying rules of the theocracy, rules that they must follow to be considered a good Muslim. Women, for example, will, because in order to get by the religious police, they will cover their hair, but with the smallest piece of cloth, which will leave a lot of their hair showing. This is deliberate. Many women are deliberately defying the religious police, and they are, according to people familiar with Iranian society, people who have lived there and gone abroad. They are either atheists or they have converted to Zoroastrianism, which is an ancient religion of Iran, or they're simply agnostic.
Yeah,
I think we see this across the board, and especially in countries that have had a tradition of secularism, of secular.
Well, and I wanted to kind of get into that a bit, because yes. Mustafa Akyol, who I know is a good friend of yours, he's been interviewed on this show twice, and when I ran this whole phenomenon by him, still trying to, you know, get a grapple on it, he said that many young people in these countries, that they have tried these, that they know the countries have been through these various isms, right? So that includes socialism, and to the extent that that was more secular, or nationalism, to the extent that that was more secular, and Islamism as well. And so they're tired of those ideologies. They know they don't work, and they're looking for something new. Do you find any credence in that possibility?
Yes, yes, I do. And what I find is that the most common ism now that youths are turning to is deism. It's different from all these other isms in that it is a private, it is private religiosity that does not involve taking orders from some organization. It's a very libertarian form of religion. And is many of the people who are who have become deist still continue for self-survival, for just to keep their jobs, to avoid getting in trouble with authorities, still pretend to be Muslims, go through the motions. They go to Friday prayers. If they're a shopkeeper, they when all the shops close on Friday at noontime, they go to the go to Friday prayers. They just go through the motions, and but they actually do the minimum, and do not in private settings when they're with trusted people, they openly say that they are not Muslim. This is quite common in Turkey and quite common in Iran and Egypt as well.
Okay, well, let's back up for a second. Now, with your research, are you mainly relying on these leaked surveys? Are you able to do any research in the field? And how does one even begin to go about measuring religiosity in the Middle East or anywhere else for that matter?
It's difficult in doing surveys is difficult, and that's why one has to with some countries one has to rely on leaked surveys. The World Values Survey is conducted in a number of countries in the Middle East. Some of them do not allow you to ask the question of whether you believe in God, whether you are they can't ask the question about religiosity. How religious are you on a scale from 1 to 5? These types of questions that are asked all around the world are asked at in some Middle Eastern countries, not others. Private researchers who try to conduct surveys in some of these countries, including Egypt, including Saudi Arabia, are prevented from asking questions, asking sensitive questions on how religious people are and what their religious belief is. So that is difficult. That is difficult. But we do, of course, we do have researchers who who live in these countries, in neighborhoods, in cities, and observe that religiosity is often performed just to protect one's reputation, rather than out of sincere
religious belief. So, how long has this research been going on? And I ask that because I'm wondering if this has been kind of a gradual decline, or are we talking about something more precipitous that has really happened or accelerated in recent years?
It's a very, very good question. It's we don't really know, but it appears to have sort of taken off around the time that the internet became common, and people who had questions about Islam, people who were struggling with these various questions of who they are, what they really believe in, could find each other through social media. Another factor is that around the time that the internet was becoming widely available in the Middle East and social media were emerging, Islamism was discrediting itself across the region. Think about the Iranian theocracy that is widely perceived as very corrupt and very repressive. Think about the disappointments generated by the Erdogan regime. Initially it was quite popular, but then it started becoming repressive. It started forcing religion onto people. So these two things coincided, and it has been a gradual a process of slow increase since then.
Interesting. One other question I had, and I'll give a little bit of background on why this has been so fascinating to me. I didn't mention before, when I was at Harvard, I actually took an accelerated 5 years of Arabic. I was thinking that I was going to go into the Foreign Service, and I did my thesis on the Hashemite regime in Jordan. So when we saw these huge numbers, I started to drill down a little bit to see if it was, everywhere, or if these views were coming from one area. And we did see kind of outperformance in Egypt, in Algeria, in Morocco. And then you also look at other research when different nationalities leave the Middle East and go to Europe, for example, Algerians having the highest intermarriage rate. So what is your understanding? And I know it can't be exact, but is this happening more in one place rather than another? Or is it across the board?
There's certainly variations. We don't have enough data. We don't have standardized data that would allow us to quantify how much this is happening in one place versus the other. It appears, though, that in countries that have suffered from Islamist repression, it is more common. And another factor is where where it's possible to go against Islam, to criticize Islam without being lynched by a mob, without suffering very dramatic consequences. We see the reactions to Islamism. We see that they're more visible in those places. We have to be careful, though, that what we observe need not be a perfect reflection of what lies under the surface. You can have people who are private, who have privately given up on Islam, privately who have converted to some other religion, who have decided they're deists rather than Muslims, but publicly you don't see the signs. So
it's certainly a very fascinating phenomenon and development. And I do want to get to our audience questions as well as talk a little bit more generally about the main body of your work of preference falsification. But I guess maybe we could just take a moment to talk about what the implications of this decline in religiosity might mean for the Middle East and, you know, really the region.
I think that one consequence is, or one possible consequence will be the emergence for the first time of a liberal variant of Islam. There have been many schisms in recent years, all coming from the stricter side. We've had ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other such movements that all demand a purer form of Islam, a stricter form, a more rigid form, a less tolerant form of Islam. But there are huge numbers of people in the region who interpret Islam differently or would like Islam to be interpreted differently. They would like exits from Islam to be free, just as entry into Islam is free. They would like to have more options. They would like to, if they're going to be a part of the religion, they would like that to reflect from what comes from within. We are now seeing shares of deists and people who consider themselves non-religious and people converting to some other religion secretly all across the region. What's missing is an organized liberal Islam or a version of Protestantism in Islam that the potential is there. There is a big constituency. Some of the people who are becoming atheist or deist might find a liberal variant of Islam to be to their liking. The potential is there, but there is no leader. And of course, there are many people. You mentioned Mustafa Akyol. He's one of them. I discuss his work in my own recent book, Freedoms Delayed. There are thinkers who studied Islam and have produced a liberal version of Islam from basic the fundamental sources of the religion. The ideas are there, but we don't yet have a leader who can found or a group of people who can found a new variant of the religion with its own places of worship, with its own funds and so on. But the potential is there. And this would be huge because it would open up debate in the Muslim world on Islam, on its interpretation, on what is the essence of the religion and what is just a custom, perhaps a pre-Islamic Arab custom that has become associated with the religion but isn't part of the core, and the opening up of discourse of public discourse
It would be great on so many fronts. I mean, it would be great for trade. It would be great for peace, you know.
It would be great for innovation, for innovation.
A lot of different things. And for women. So I'm going to get to a few of these questions. A lot of them, I think, we've already covered with your answers to my previous questions. But My Modern Galt asks, is there evidence of Islam rising or declining outside of the Middle East? Do followers decline over time, or do those numbers get replaced by new Muslim immigrants?
It's a very good question, because this phenomenon that I've identified is specific to the Middle East. And the Middle East happens to be within the wider Muslim world, which contains about 56 countries that are majority Muslim. Those countries in the Middle East, which I define as the entire Arab world, plus Iran, plus Turkey, those in the Middle East are much more repressive than societies elsewhere. There is less disillusionment with Islam in other countries that are substantially, on average, substantially freer, not only in terms of religious freedoms, but expressive freedoms generally, freedoms, internet freedoms, social freedoms, women's freedoms, and so on. So I think this is this phenomenon of widespread covert exits from Islam is at the moment especially pronounced in the Middle East. Islam is, as a religion on the whole, it is growing. It continues to compete with Christianity in Africa, which is pretty much the only part of the world where population is growing rapidly, and there has been for decades a competition between Christianity and Islam to convert people there. Islam is still advancing, as is Christianity there.
Interesting. You know, I think I would have almost thought it was the opposite, but what you are saying is that in these countries that are both religious and authoritarian and are trying to maintain religiosity by these more stringent measures, that it's actually backfiring. Maybe you'd talk a little bit, since it is very close to your home, is President Erdogan in Turkey, and how he has tried to bring back religion there. What kind of effect is that having?
When he came to power now 22 years ago, he committed himself to creating a pious generation. And to that end, he imposed mandatory religion classes in schools. He dramatically increased the number of religious schools where, as opposed to the secular schools, which still exist. In many neighborhoods, essentially forced kids to go to a religious school because the closest secular school was far away. And so the deliberate strategy to make the population more religious, well, what has happened is that this has, as you pointed out, it has backfired. Religiosity is declining in Turkey. Mosque attendance, as far as we can tell, is declining. The major mosque that he built on a huge hill in Istanbul has, on some days, this is a massive congregational mosque that can take thousands and thousands of people. On some days, You go and you see a total of 15 or 20 people using the mosque for praying. It looks like a European church on a typical day. European churches are or the great cathedrals of in Europe, where religiosity has declined greatly. So it is actually backfiring. And of the people who are still attending at least Friday service, a substantial portion are doing so for show.
Interesting. Here's a question that caught my eye from Lock, Stock, and Barrel. Good to see you again, my friend. Why did the Arab Spring fall apart?
That's also a very good question, and I address it directly in my latest book, Freedoms Delayed. The Arab Spring was not generated by organized groups. It was a spontaneous eruption of people who were coordinated over the internet. And even the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the largest non-state organization in the Middle East, even the Muslim Brotherhood stood on the sidelines until it was clear that Mubarak was fallen. But when Mubarak was toppled, there was no organization, or no organizations, I could say, that were strong enough and had a substantial enough base apart from the Muslim Brotherhood to carry forward the reforms. Civil society is very weak in all across the Middle East and in Egypt. And this has historical reasons. The Middle East entered the 20th century with a very weak civil society. Just very briefly, because I spent six chapters identifying why, the Middle East did not have a concept of a corporation that was absolutely essential to the development of civil society in Western Europe. Schools, religious orders, professional organizations, all got organized as corporations. And this enabled them to become powerful, to get seats at the, and ultimately get seats at the political bargaining table. The Middle East didn't have anything similar to this. The closest analog of the in the Middle East was a trust known as the Waqf. It did not have legal personality. It could not. It was not self-governing. It was governed from the grave by the founder, and it did not play a political role. So the Middle East has been building a civil society, but from a very weak base in the 20th century, and the authoritarian rulers that have been able to cement power and stay in power for decades, partly because civil society is so weak, have made a point of keeping it as weak as possible. Egypt is a very good example. Civil society was very weak. There were no organizations that could constrain the military after the Arab Spring, with the exception of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it is the Muslim Brotherhood that won the first election, came to power, but the military regrouped and toppled the Muslim Brotherhood. And there's now a dictatorship that is even harsher than the Sisi dictatorship, is even harsher than the Mubarak dictatorship. Wow. That the Arab Spring toppled.
All right. Well, we're starting to get some questions coming in here on preference falsification, which, of course, I mentioned that my interview with Todd Rose brought your work to my attention. I think you coined the term preference falsification back in the 80s. So before we even dive into some of these questions, maybe you would tell us what the term means and why do people feel the need to fit in the first place?
So preference falsification is the act of misrepresenting one's preferences in public in response to perceived pressures. The pressures may or may not be, the perception may or may not be accurate. It could be that everyone at the dinner table or a certain topic comes up, agrees with you, but you suspect that people would object, would criticize you if you express your honest opinion. And it could be that everyone else at the table is doing exactly the same thing. So you could be privately in agreement. There could be a consensus, a private consensus, and publicly you're all paying lip service to something else. So that is the act of preference falsification. The second part of your question was, if you could just
why do people want to fit in? Yeah, why? I guess because I've never had that inclination.
People feel a need to falsify their preferences, first of all, to avoid punishments, to avoid ostracism, be accepted by groups. The academics want to be accepted as somebody reasonable. They don't want to be canceled, so they may avoid voicing certain opinions, voicing certain objections to university policies or actions. They want to get their article to develop a reputation as a right-wing nut, let's say, to and anger journal editors. They also falsify their preferences for to get rewards. People who voice certain preferences are considered more moral. They are given they qualify by virtue of what they're saying publicly for favors from the administration, favors from leaders of their profession. So
So there obviously are benefits to preference falsification. What are some of the drawbacks for individuals who are misrepresenting their views?
Psychologically, when we falsify our preferences, we feel diminished. We feel that there's a part of us that we can't, that we are not, that is being suppressed. We feel victimized because of that. We also feel that insofar as others are imitating us, others are looking to us for leadership, that we're letting others down. We're playing a part in maintaining an inefficient status quo. Playing a part in letting somebody's reputation be destroyed by not speaking up, by not saying what we really believe. This generates guilt. This generates a feeling of a victimization. And of course, when preference falsification becomes spreads, and it becomes when the context in which we falsify preferences broaden, the feeling of victimization, the bad feelings, the guilt grows, and that's an explosive situation, of course.
Yeah, I mean, guilt, yes. I would say fear, for sure. One thing that we focus on here at the Atlas Society, well, our audience is largely young people, and I've had experts on intergenerational differences come on to talk about like what is unique to Gen Z, for example. And one of the things that they found was that they were really high in terms of cynicism as well as fear. And maybe that is because they really were coming to age in an era where social media was also exacerbating the extent to which certain narratives were being maintained. And but academia has probably got to be the worst. So I've got some interesting questions. Candice Morena, who is a big fan of your work, by the way, asks about Duke University. Has it come out with a statement regarding the new executive order regarding affirmative action? How do you think academia across the U.S. is going to respond?
Duke has not, to date, adopted institutional neutrality or recommitted itself to academic freedoms or free speech the way quite a few others, about 20 other peer institutions have done. But there is a faculty group that is pushing the university in that direction. I do not yet know, since the new executive order nullifying the executive Lyndon Johnson's executive order of 1965. It just came out just a few hours ago. I do not know how the Duke University administration is going to respond. I am pretty sure that a majority of the faculty privately are delighted. Affirmative action is unpopular among faculty, although publicly few of them will say this. The Duke Chronicle ran a poll at the end of the last academic year among our 5,500 faculty and asking questions about institutional neutrality and questions, and there was a question about DEI. A supermajority of the faculty had very serious reservations about DEI and they favored institutional neutrality. But an initiative, a faculty initiative that I'm a part of to get faculty to put this in writing, go public with their request for institutional neutrality, their feeling that their preference for stronger academic freedoms and stronger protections for free speech. Only 3% of our faculty so far have
been willing to come and
so
forward.
This is an indication of massive preference falsification.
Wow.
On campus. And I've talked to hundreds. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, please. Another example of a preference falsification might be what Ilyushin is asking in this question and wanting to know whether you have any insights into the whole COVID time with the perceived kind of rising support for authoritarian measures, censorship since COVID and the 2020 elections. Is that playing a role? Might that also be subsiding as well?
It might be subsiding. I certainly hope that it subsides. That's a very good example of preference falsification generating a massive divergence between private preferences and public preferences, and private knowledge and public knowledge, even in a country where the Constitution guarantees free speech. The fact well, we can, the Constitution guarantees free speech doesn't mean that people will exercise it.
You know, it's not enough to have a First Amendment and constitutional protections. We really need to foster and cultivate a culture of free speech, and we need to do that by exercising our own free speech. Okay, we've got less than 15 minutes, and I know there are some questions here that I really wanted to get to. We talked about the harms for individuals when they falsify their preferences. I want to talk about the consequences for an organization or a movement. For example, at the Atlas Society, we promote open objectivism, which emphasizes civil debate and discussion with those who hold different views. Then there is the whole closed objectivists who hold that such a discussion would constitute a sanctioning of those views to the extent that some would not even be willing to come on my show. They would consider that immoral. So how effective can such a closed approach be to maintaining a certain orthodoxy over time?
You have an orthodoxy in an organization, regardless of what the orthodoxy is, and regardless it's the merits of the orthodoxy when it emerges, if it is not challenged, if it is not constantly challenged, as conditions change, as preferences change, as opportunities change, if there isn't a culture of freely questioning the orthodoxy, of freely pointing to its defects, of freely pointing to the need for rethinking a part of the package, the sanctioned package, then the organization is going to become dysfunctional. There will be disillusionment. There will be people who start disagreeing with the movement and feeling uncomfortable with the movement, with the organization, but initially not being able to say something. But eventually these inner pressures will increase, and at some point they will blow up. And it might happen at a time when the organization is greatly weakened, precisely because it hasn't along the way been responding to the insights of its members, its employees.
As Ayn Rand herself would say, you know, you can avoid reality, but you can't avoid the consequences of avoiding reality.
Now, very well said.
I'd like to kind of get into some, maybe perhaps even historical parallels between various events that you've written about in history, things like the Bolshevik Revolution or the French Revolution. These seemed rather shocking at the time. People were not expecting them, but you said that they could be explained to an extent by preference falsification. Are there any parallels with what we might be experiencing in America? I mean, people have found the whole Brexit or Trump's election and re-election as shocking. So are we seeing parallels with regards to preference falsification, which if it hadn't happened, these things might not be such, people wouldn't be so blindsided?
Yes, there's certainly parallels. Let me start with the revolution. Some of the greatest, the most consequential revolutions in history, including the French Revolution, the 1917 Russian Revolution, the Iranian Revolution that shook the Middle East, the Arab Spring we talked about. These came as a huge surprise to everybody concerned, including the world's leading intelligence organizations. One of the reasons is that In all of these cases, you had oppressive regimes that were not allowing people who had become disillusioned, people who wanted something different, people who wanted their their needs addressed, that they were not allowed to speak openly. And they were forced to pay lip service to the existing regime's greatness. So what happens is that in a situation like that, as discontent increases, the degree of preference falsification increases, you just need some event that will make a few people say, enough is enough. I am fed up with this regime. And they go into the opposition and they start a cascade that brings down the regime. This is what we saw this in the case of the Russian Revolution. We saw this in the case of the Iranian Revolution. We saw it in the Arab Spring. The opposition at some point just started growing, feeding on itself until the opposition became so large that the regime could no longer govern. Now, in a democratic society, one where you do have regular elections, you're not going to have a situation, you're not going to have exactly the same situation, because there will still be people who will be expressing their opposition. And certainly before, when Trump ran in 2016, polls were showing that a substantial portion of the American electorate was favorable to Trump and was opposed to Hillary. But there were enough people who were not telling pollsters the truth. They were afraid to say, even to a pollster that they might not have even known personally, that they would vote for Trump. They pretended to be a Hillary supporter. And of course, the rest is history. They went into the ballot box, voted for Trump, and that was the 2016 shock.
I mean, let's get to this term that you've used, preference cascade. I think you've argued that with the inauguration of President Trump earlier this week, you suggested that his success might be linked to a preference cascade where individuals felt more comfortable expressing previously hidden sentiments after seeing others do so. I've heard other terms like permission structures being created by people who are willing to go out there and say things that others are too afraid to be true. So do you think that has been at play here, particularly with more and more in the tech world voicing their support?
Absolutely. The another term that I'd like to introduce here is the Overton window. The Overton window is the range of facts, arguments, claims that can be expressed publicly. In the tech world, that Overton window broadened before the election, and the same happened in other parts of society. A big factor in this was the purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. Not only was the algorithm changed, did Elon Musk change the algorithm so that previously deprioritized tweets or posts would get more priority. That in itself was a big shift, and it made people who had reservations about the orthodoxy that Twitter had been promoting, the people with objections realized that they're actually more, their views are more common than they had previously thought. Another factor, though, is that Twitter, or when it became X, changed made an important change to how the like function works. Previously, you could see if a certain post had been 30 people had liked it, you could see who those 30 people were. Musk changed it so that only the person who had sent the post or the tweet could see who had liked it. Other people could not. So people felt people who liked controversial posts felt freer to like posts than they were in the past. And Musk also said that likes would get greater weight than reposts in where they would appear in where the posts would appear in people's feeds. Now, the important difference is that it is now private preferences that is driving whose voice will be heard, rather than public preferences. So I think this played an important role in getting a preference cascade on various issues, various controversial issues, whether it's affirmative action or the role that race and ethnic identity play in various spheres of life, whether it's the use of pronouns, right. The open window widened dramatically, and that just encouraged, and that encouraged as the window started widening, that encouraged further widening. That gave people the courage.
I didn't know about that change, and I think that's a really positive development because previously the Puritans, if you will, to use a term from Brendan O'Neill and Andrew Doyle, had been out there, and if they saw that somebody of their tribe had liked a post that they're not supposed to like, I mean, this could lead to people having to apologize or get canceled or even resign. So I think that being able to get more integrity, more alignment between private and public is going to be a very good thing. But I think we also need to take care that we don't kind of fall victim to preference falsification on the other side. Because I mean, if you look across all of these different tech companies, they are people that work there donate overwhelmingly to Democrats. And so we wouldn't want to have a situation where people that are making private donations to support particular candidates now feel, oh my goodness, it's Elon Musk and Mark Andreessen and this one and that one, and that they begin to falsify their preferences to
fit in. We can get another one orthodoxy getting replaced by another. Ideally, we have free speech and we have ideas just battling each other constantly.
All right. Well, as we are continuing to move forward in that battle, Professor, where is the best way for people to follow your work?
Well, my website for the papers I write and other academic work, but I'm active also on X. I comment daily on events of the day, on academic developments, on university affairs, and so that's another place to follow me.
And engage, and we will do that. So this has been absolutely delightful. I've been really looking forward to this for a long time. So thank you, Professor. I really appreciate your being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Jag, for the opportunity.
And I want to thank all of you who joined us, asked your very smart questions. Of course, if you like our work, please sure to support us. We are a nonprofit. And Professor, if you have young people that you think would like to go to our student conference in Austin this coming June, we'll also put that link in the chat. And I want to encourage those of you who are you don't have to be in college. You could be young adults. You should apply, get a scholarship to come and join us. I would love to see you there. Be sure to join us next week when author Brendan O'Neill rejoins us to talk about his latest book, After the Pogrom, 7 October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. So we'll see you then.